Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. I'm AD Packham and we're having a quick glance over our shoulders in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Yes, that's right. Last Saturday's defeat at Newcastle was our fourth in a row, and it saw us looking down the table rather than up for the first time in a little while. Add to that this week's fixture list with Liverpool visiting today and then Spurs on Wednesday, and it all looks a little bit daunting. However, our record against the top sides of late has proved that we can go into these games without any fear and hope that we can add more points to the total before the international break. Of course, all that seemed a little bit trivial with the events going on in Ukraine and then the knock-on effects that it's having on Chelsea after Roman Abramovich has now been sanctioned by the government and his assets frozen, including Chelsea. Joining me today as we look at all of that is, of course, Alan Wares. And we welcome back a boffin, a guru, a spreadsheet nerd. It's, of course, Kieran Maguire. And we also hear from an Albion legend who played 177 times for the Albion, scoring 7 goals. But he's probably more famously known as a man that once gave Kieran a medal as a 16-year-old. Welcome back to Mark Lawrenson.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
So, Kieran, I mean, you told me about this story in the week. What were your memories of being given a medal as a 16-year-old by an Albion legend?
Oh, that's absolutely made up. Mark was absolutely brilliant. I'm old enough to remember when he was a gazelle in a herd of buffalo as far as the Albion were concerned, and it was without doubt the most gifted player of his generation for the club, and it was an honour to watch him.
Well, what do you want? Just how many notes on the check do you want?
I don't know. Ask the ghost of Mike Bamber.
Yeah,
that's another.
Yeah, apparently Mike Bamber owes you some money, Laura.
He owes me 30 grand. He owes me my ex gratia payment when he sold me. So they only made 800 grand on me.
I was reading some interesting stuff about that. I mean, I think we've probably spoken about it on this show before when you've been on. But I mean, it was the beginning of the spat between Bamber and Alan Mullery that apparently he agreed to sell you to Rod Atkinson at Man United, and Bamber then did a deal with Liverpool.
Yeah, well, the thing with Muller's doing the deal was he wanted 3 Man United players who had all agreed. So that took a bit of time to actually, make that agreement. And I wasn't party to any of that. I didn't know anything about it. The first thing I knew about the fact I was potentially moving was I got a call from Switzerland with a journo, Colin Wood, who covered Liverpool. And they were ringing me up the next day and making an offer. And Ron Atkinson then called me and obviously told me about what his plans were, that I was going to go to there, etc. And in the meantime, Arsenal came on as well. So basically on the next day, I could go to any of the 3 teams. And I didn't know anything about the what Mike Bamber had done in terms of Mullers at all. I was just being told, you're free to go and speak to the clubs. But eventually it came through that obviously Liverpool were going to pay cash for me. And they weren't sending any players because Jimmy Case came eventually, but he wasn't part of the deal. So that was what it was. And he'd always promised me, Mike Bamber, that he'd obviously given me 30 grand. Because he was, not that I've got a thing about it, you realise, but just because he said, yeah, I'll do it anyway. When push come to shove, he shoved. And I didn't should have pushed him.
It's not even inflation adjusted, is it, you're after? It's the flat 30 grand from then with white fivers. Well,
it was as our expert knows in Liverpool, it was tax free, so it's worth even more.
I'm going to say this in all seriousness because I mean, when it comes to transfers and rumours and what have you, there's always sort of people making their own living out of starting rumours, especially when it comes to close season and January and what have you. But I think it's a mark of Mark's standing in the game and certainly at Brighton that we have these stories floating around about maybe Ibrahim or this player or that player when they're doing well at the Albion. But when you've got one Brighton player who's actually being courted by Liverpool, Manchester United and Arsenal, who are probably then as now 3 of the biggest teams in the country, in fact, probably the biggest teams in the country, it gives you an idea of Mark's elevated status at a club which was, I'm going to say fortunate, it was it was kind of a stepping stone between Preston and then the Jays at Liverpool. I mean, let's make no bones about it. It's not a particularly diplomatic thing for us to say, but it's still the case. But it's, I'm going to say this to those who don't necessarily remember Mark being here and who want to know about the history, that this is how good a player he was. And I think the nature of his career at Liverpool ended up being a proof of that.
You know, I think I saw somebody voting the other day for the best Albion player ever and stuff like that. And the big centre-half got it, didn't he? And it was a really good argument. What's his name? His name always... I always forget his name.
Steve Foster?
No, not Foster.
Lewis Dunk?
Yeah, Lewis Dunk. I don't know what it... Somebody sent me a snapshot of it. And I said, well, that's, you know, because people forget all the other old players and stuff like that and forget what they did. But... And I'm not asked about it, to be honest with you. But then I saw somebody tweet and he went, well, you know what? If you actually think about this logically, he said, Lawrenson was sold to the then European champions.
Yeah.
So he said, maybe that tells you something about it. So, hey, it is what it is. But you know what? I had 4 or 5 years there. I love it. Loved it to death.
Yeah. I mean, you said to us previously, it was the happiest time of your career because there was no pressure.
Yeah. Well, man, there was pressure. It wasn't that. It was just... It was really, well, listen, you win games, if you're winning football and getting paid, it's good. But also, it was just the camaraderie as well, because nearly all the players in that era had been bought in. I think apart from Tony Towner and dear old Steve Piper, I think we were all bought in from clubs everywhere. And Brian Houghton basically was our manager on the pitch. But also, you know, we used to do things like we'd go and play away from home, obviously, and we'd all have to go back into the pub. Afterwards, after we got off the bus, we had to go in the pub. We didn't have to have a drink, or you could have an orange juice and you could bugger off after 5 minutes, but we all had to go back. We did, the whole place was the pub. I don't suppose it's still going.
Yeah, it is,
That was it, all right. And it was just stuff like that. It really felt like a big family. I had an old English sheepdog called Barnaby. I used to take him into the office when we were training and the girls would look after him. That's how good a club it was.
We've had various people on from your era, and I'm talking about the likes of Chris Catlin and Andy Rollings, and slightly later, admittedly, Danny Wilson. But I think that I want to talk about this as kind of Steve Foster being the stopgap. And obviously, you turned up before Foster. But what was the nature of the club that you were strongly persuaded to join? But what was the culture of the club that you joined?
The Albion when I joined.
Yeah.
It was great. Well, you just got promotion from what would have been the old third division.
Mm.
And Crossy, I mean, Graham Cross went to Preston, didn't he? Mm-hmm. If you remember, and Harry Wilson, Graham Cross and Harry Wilson went to, one went to Preston, one went to Burnley. But Crossy got player of the year at Brighton. Mm. And then I turn up and some oik from the north and they're thinking, who the hell's this kid and stuff. But now it was really, the vibe of the club was really, really good. And Mullers was great. I mean, his bark was worse than his bite, but you can only speak as you find. He was just absolutely brilliant with me, apart from the fact he thought I was the worst trainer in the world. And I said, well, training doesn't really make any difference. It's what you do on a Saturday, isn't it, that counts. But no, it was just a really good, friendly club with some very, very good players. Look at some of the players who went on. You know, Gary Stevens, obviously, John Gregory. Mm. Wardy, you know, we had some really good footballers.
Okay, Mark. I mean, out of all of the players you played with at the Albion, who do you think would have made, if you could put them in a time machine and fast forward them to now, who would be the biggest player in the market?
In the market, well, you know what, I'm going to go with Nobby, with Brian, because you can't get Brian Houghtons of this world, you can't get Graeme Souness's, Roy Keane's. And that's what Nobby was. Nobby was just like everything about. I could never speak highly enough about him. And he wasn't just a good, you know, organised central midfield player. He sorted referees out. He sorted the opposition out. You know, he was just brilliant. I mean, he now, I always said at the time that if he could have run, as in if he was quick, he would have played in the top six in the old Division One that it was. And I always said he was the closest thing to Souness that I'd ever played with.
Yeah. Now, Kieran, I mean, obviously, I mean, you just celebrated a big birthday, so happy birthday. But I mean, you would have seen a lot more of Mark than we probably did at the time. So, well, I mean, talk us through your memories of watching him play.
I think the greatest moment I saw Mark play was we played Wolves. I think we were still in the third division at the time, or just got the second division in the League Cup. Mark picked up the ball on the edge of his own penalty box and ran forward 70 yards, skipped past two players and just stroked it into the north stand. And we went, well, we lost the match 3-2, but it's still one of the goals of all time from my point of view as a fan of that era.
Do you know something about that? Do you remember Steve Daly?
Oh, yeah.
Well, Steve Daly went for $1 million, didn't he? He was a second £1 million player ever. And technically, I went for $1 million just after. So we were playing against each other. But the other thing I need to tell you, I think Paul Bradshaw was in goal for Wolves. And I'm pretty sure he was. He didn't have the best of eyesight. Because you probably made it sound a little bit better. I just hit it and it went past him. I really don't know how, but there you go.
Now, I mean, it was Mark. I mean, fast forward a little bit. It was Mike. It was Mike Bailey that sold you in the end. And but it was that season, the Albion achieved their highest ever position in the top flight. We're getting close to surpassing that this season. Obviously, we've hit a little bit of a blip of late. But I mean, we're certainly on target for that. So, I mean, give us your view on the current Albion crop.
Oh, they're good. I mean, you know, look, it starts at the top, doesn't it, with the owner. I mean, what Tony Bloom's done for that football club is just beyond respect. And you have no doubt, I do believe. And Graham's actually done a really, really good job. And I think the point of this is if you improve as a new manager in the Premier League every year upon year, then you're doing a good job. I mean, the only problem is you're drawing too many games. But I watched your Old Trafford, I was at the game. And you should have actually beaten Man United. You had a couple of chances in the first half, which you should have buried. And they were there for the taking. They were all over the place. And you know, the way they kept the ball, everything about them, you could just tell they were extremely well coached. You're almost there. You're almost there as in being top 10. You just, unfortunately, the hardest thing in the game is to score goals, and that's the problem you've got. But you've no problems other than that.
Alan?
Is it a side that you'd like to play in, Mark?
If you let me run forward from the back, yeah. Listen, definitely. Because, you know, they pass it out from the back. Absolutely great. And they did it really, really comfortable. And, you know, I was watching lyrically about them when they were playing at Man United. I got slaughtered by Man United fans. But Brighton were outstanding. They were outstanding that night.
Okay. Well, actually, Laura, I was going to touch on this a little bit later on, but you brought it up, so I'm going to do this now. Because I want to thank you because there was something you said that night which really, really rang brilliantly with me, which was... And this is basically a lot of like media bias. It happens a lot to us.
Yeah.
Everyone was talking about the problems of Man United and how they weren't very good and everything. But nobody was talking about Brighton. Then you actually said, "Oh, hang on a minute. Let's talk about how good Brighton are in this game. It's not all about Man United. There were two teams playing here tonight, and you know, and that is such a rare thing to hear."
Well, there was no bias. It was just the fact they outplayed Man United purely and simply. And I think even Ranić admitted, if you read between the lines of what he said, obviously he couldn't say that in too much about the opposition because he'd just beaten them. But if you read between the lines, he was saying, my God, the game was a really, really good game. And in the end, we've nicked 3 points. Mm.
Did you know that Ralf Rangnick was once played for Southwick?
I did because somebody told me, and he used to come and watch the games, didn't he?
Yeah.
Did you know that?
Yeah, he was actually a student at Sussex University while you were at the Albion. So, yeah, he would actually come along just as an interested fan. I don't think he was really had designs in football management at the time. And apparently those who played alongside him at Southwick thought he was rubbish. But, you know, from tiny acorns, the great trees grow.
Yeah, well, it's like Houllier. Houllier was a teacher in Liverpool, wasn't he? And, you know, just used to go to the games and lo and behold, he ended up being the manager.
Speaking of teachers in Liverpool, Kieran.
Well, Kieran, I mean, so do you fancy the, I don't know, the Arsenal job next?
I'm too busy on Channel 5 doing the Chelsea story.
I did a story on Channel 5 News. They actually came and knocked on my door during lockdown, which was interesting, but it was...
So Kieran, all that I know you've just talked about Mark and what you thought his positive qualities on the pitch were, but the story that he tells about the culture at the Albion at the time. Now, my first game at the Albion, Mark was playing in, but I was 8 and I don't remember a huge amount about it. So, you know, yours is probably a better memory of it. So all the things that Mark was talking about with the culture, is that what came across for the fans as well, when you saw Mark on the pitch?
Yeah, there was things like the Seagull special for away matches where you just felt that, yes, they are the team and they're the team that we support, but they were just such a grounded bunch. I think I once took Neil McNabb's dog for a walk. It was that type of club because he was sort of wandered up and he looked a bit lost. So I took his dog for a walk, and it was a friendly. There was no pretensions. They did seem to be very much together, and that was something that we bought into, and it can make that difference. I remember in 80-81. Where we needed to win the last four matches of the season. And I was at Sunderland. I think there was 50 Albion fans there. But they fought until the last minute and Gary Williams scored a superb goal. And you can tell how much it meant to the team then. And they were very much as one.
Well, sorry.
The foot story to that was we flew up. For once, we actually decided to fly us up. And I tell you what, it was like a hurricane. And we were all sick as dogs getting off the plane, right? And of course you go, Christ almighty, we're never ever going to win here. Absolutely no chance. Yeah, and Willow scored one of his few wonder goals. Yeah. So, yeah.
He didn't score rubbish goals. Say this, I've got to ask Mark this.
Go on.
Now, I know, I believe that you were injured, but were you, so I want to go into the Northeast. Were you at that promotion game at Newcastle?
Yeah, Muller's made me go.
And you know what? Broken arm? Was it?
Yeah, I had a broken arm. I couldn't bloody put my clothes on or clean my teeth and everything. He said, "You're coming with us." They went on Wednesday. And I think, I don't know if they had a game of golf or something. And I said to Mullis, "Look," I said, "this is a nightmare." I was having to get my mother to come down and sort me out, comb my hair and everything. And I said, "I can't." He said, "You're coming with us. You're coming with us." So obviously, the day of the game, I sit in the stand with Mike Bamber. Thinking he might give me 30 grand one day, this boy. No, I'm joking. So I'm sat next to Mike Bamber. And of course, we score early. In fact, we won easy. I think Nobby scored with a header, didn't he? Jerry Ryan scored. Maybe Wardy scored as well, I think.
Yeah, so, he did, yeah.
Yeah. And so at the end of the game, I've gone to go on the pitch. And a policeman came and sort of arrested me. But I had like a white sort of coat thing on, jacket. And you could obviously see that my arm was strapped up and everything. Get off, son. And I went, no, I play for these. He went, get off, son. And I said, no, honestly. And then I think, I don't know whether it was the kit man or something. So I said, no, he's one of the players. But that train journey was the best train journey.
This is what I wanted to talk to you about.
Well, that train journey was the best train journey of all of our lives, by the way. And it felt like it took 3 days, but it was 3 days worth of, it was mad. It was mad.
Yeah. What happens on the train stays on the train is what I understand.
I would think that's probably the best outcome, definitely.
I think the cleanest story I've heard is that I think it was Jerry Ryan's wife was waiting.
Simeon.
She was waiting for him on Haywards Heath station platform. And somehow, I don't know if he could, give 30 grand to the driver and say, look, and the train just went flying by and they could see her on the platform going, what? And the train just went flying on by straight into Brighton and a 2 o'clock sort of, it was near ticker tape welcome, wasn't it, at Brighton station?
I don't really remember that. I just remember the next day we went down on the seafront, don't we, and the bus and everything. We started at the ground. I don't remember the ticker tape thing, but then at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Big cheering, yeah.
Yeah, big cheering then, yeah. Oh, look, they're all pissed. Yeah. What they've been doing.
I mean, I was going to say earlier, actually, because when Kieran mentioned the Seagulls Express, your face just lit up like Christmas, like a Christmas tree. It was like, I think plenty of things happened on those trains, and that were
talking of transport, AD. I do have to repeat the story of our good friend Dave Horsted and his one and only time up here. I think he was 18 and a squaddy, and they'd driven a van up there up to Newcastle to go to the game, and they've got, you know, got the promotion, stayed in town, got wasted, blah blah blah. And ended up staying in Newcastle for about 4 days because they forgot where they parked the van.
Brilliant. Brilliant. I'm with them.
So if you remember that day, Mark, you weren't there.
Yeah, well, there is actually TV footage of him in the dressing room and on the pitch after that, Al. So it was like... I think it's on YouTube somewhere, but...
I've never seen that.
Hey, sorry, just last little bit. Kieran, were you there at Newcastle that day?
I was on Marine Parade. I was refereeing a kids' tournament. I couldn't get a ticket. I tried to get a ticket for the match and hadn't been successful because I think we took about 7,000. But you know, if everybody who was there, who claims to be there, was actually there, it would have been 100,000 capacity grain.
Yeah. What, you mean like Brentford in 87?
That kind of thing, yeah. The two things that always think remind me of that are everyone seemed to be at the Jam's last concert and everyone seemed to be at the Lyceum to see Bob Marley in 1977.
I think Kieran actually was at the Jam concert, weren't you?
Hey, no, I saw Bob Marley in Brighton.
At the Dome?
Well, playing left.
No, it wasn't at the Dome. I think the thing on the place on the front.
The centre?
Yeah, I think it was at the centre, yeah.
Oh, right.
And the three, he had three big mamas and I'm trying to be, you know, and they came on, and they must have just kept singing Marley, Marley for about 15 minutes. And then all of a sudden, I'm thinking, what's that smell in here? And of course, obviously, it was the ganja, wasn't it? We were all at the back, the boys were all at the back, and it was a ganja. It was sensational. Do you know something? What a fab player he was. Did you know about that?
Yes, he was.
He was a proper player. He wasn't one of those pop stars that, oh, yeah, I play football, could have signed for Brentford and all that rubbish. He actually was a really, really good player. Yeah.
I mean, I was going to talk about Liverpool, all right, but you just opened a can of worms. So who else did you see when you were at Brighton?
I saw, I don't like Mondays, Boomtown Rats.
Right.
Right. And they kind of climbed down from this big stage and everything, and people started spitting at them because it was that era, wasn't it?
It was beginning of punk, yeah.
And he went mad. Your man, Geldof, went absolutely eight as only he could do and basically said, if you don't stop spitting, we're off, which was fair enough because they were spoiling it for everybody.
Absolutely.
But he was, he can't sing for toffee, can he?
No, not really.
Well, he can't, did he? He only had one hit, didn't he? I mean, let's be fair.
He had a few, to be honest. He had a few. Yeah. And he raised a few quid for charity as well.
Oh, he did brilliantly. He did brilliantly for charity.
Well, it's actually Kieran at the moment, who I can see it's a big day for him because he's got a shirt and jumper on, whereas normally I'd expect at least a Joy Division T-shirt.
Okay.
I'm still recovering from trying to be posh for BBC Breakfast and Co. I did have a dog with me this morning because the wife had gone out.
Did you have a dog on the BBC Breakfast with you?
Yeah, well, I was sitting on my sofa here.
It was hosting it. Dan wasn't in, was he? My mate Dan. No.
No. It was Nagger and Charlie.
Nagger and Charlie. Yeah, that's a double act, isn't it?
Okay. Well, look. I know you've got something else to do shortly, so we'll move it swiftly on to this weekend. Obviously, Liverpool are visiting the Amex. On your regular thing on the BBC website, you predicted a 2-0 victory to Liverpool. Actually, our record against teams like Liverpool is pretty good. In fact, actually 5 points out of the last three games. Obviously, we're on a crest of the slump at the moment with the four straight defeats. And this actually represents a good chance for us to get something out. I mean, it's a free hit. Liverpool have to win, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, listen, you know, I think it'll be tight. But the thing with Liverpool now is, and this is really unusual at the big clubs when they're chasing trophies and stuff, they've got everybody's fit. Absolutely everybody's fit. There's no long-term illnesses. There's the odd knock or niggle. He's got two players for every position. And I don't know if you've been watching them much lately, but quite often in games, he makes three substitutions now with about 20 minutes left. And in two of the games, it's completely changed the outcome of the game. So that's a worry. If the first 11 aren't particularly at it, as far as he's concerned, he just changes it. And, you know, they've just got some real, real top players. I hope for your sake that Thiago plays, because honestly, you watch this fella play, he has his socks down, right? And he's one of the best footballers I've ever seen. Midfield player, nothing of him. He's got radar. He just knows when players are around him. And he makes them play. I mean, you know, your Hendersons and Fabinho's outstanding players. But this fella is just completely different. He makes it look ridiculously easy.
Okay. Well, we're going to be talking about Chelsea in a little bit. But, I mean...
You're not making us feel any better here, Mark. You know, well, like you say, we're on a Christmas lunch. And here you are saying, oh, Liverpool are about to take you apart.
Yeah. Well, listen, hey, the other thing is that I think Firmino's now, he's trained, so he's fit. So there's Firmino, Jota, Diaz, Mane, Salah. Apart from that, it should be fine for you.
Yeah, easy.
But what I was going to say was, I mean, obviously, we're going to be talking about Chelsea a little bit later on. But, I mean, the Liverpool way in the transfer market, I mean, Chelsea have taken a more scattergun approach of late. And where Liverpool seems to be a lot more considered. And, you know, when they are bringing in players, you know, they brought in Van Dijk, who ironically could have been playing for Brighton tomorrow. But, well, probably not anymore. But we were after him before he went to Celtic. And it came very, very close. But they've just brought in Diaz. And he's someone that is really, like, hit the ground running, isn't he?
Yeah. Well, if you look, apart from Van Dijk and Alisson, obviously, who were 70-odd million each, and, you know, you could double that for the sale of both of them. But generally, when Klopp's been buying players, they've been in between the 30 and 40 million bracket. And so they're not kind of world-class when they come. They're certainly very, very good. He makes them into world-class players. And I think that's the secret. Listen, you know, at any football club nowadays, the two most important positions are the manager and head of recruitment. Because if you get it right as head of recruitment, A, you can just improve your team fantastically, but also you can make money. You can, you know, even if you're of the opinion, all right, we sell one every year. If you've got one that's 40 million, you sell him every year, it's running your club.
Yeah.
You know?
Sorry, Kieran, the figures that Mark is throwing around there, 30, 40 million, and they're not world beaters. I mean, for us to be able to purchase someone for 30 or 40 million is still actually sort of daydream fantasy stuff, should we ever want to go down that road anyway. But, I mean, it's as a football, you know, finance expert, these numbers are bewildering. And yet, with, like I say, with Mark quite correctly saying about the amount that Liverpool spend compared to what we spend, it's something quite astonishing that we can actually therefore still compete with them.
I think you've got to give the Albion some credit in terms of their recruitment to allow that to happen. But it's also a function of the Premier League being the other 14 teams, for want of a better phrase, in the Premier League are themselves the sixth biggest league in Europe. So we've got the top six of the Premier League. We've got the Bundesliga, you know, the Spanish, Italian. And then where do players then go? The Albion and, you know, even small clubs such as Crystal Palace, they can afford to pay more money in terms of wages than clubs in Portugal, clubs in the Netherlands, clubs in Belgium and so on. So if you recruit well from those markets, you can have an excellent squad. You look at the players that the Albion have got. We've got an Argentinian international, a Belgian international. We've got Neil Mopay, who, you know, is a really good striker. Adam Webster, if he hadn't been injured, I think he would have been on, you know, knocking on the door of playing for England and so on. And this is coming from Brighton Hove Albion, who ultimately are a club with a bottom six budget as far as the Premier League is concerned, but that still allows them to outbuy an awful lot of clubs in Europe, and that's why the Premier League is so competitive. There's no gimmies in that league.
Well, listen, a really good understanding of it is if you say the top six can shop at Harrods and the rest shop at Aldi, you get bargains at Aldi, don't you? That's what you want. You've got to get bargains. That's what it's all about at that level. And you just train them up and sell them on and keep doing it. And by the way, the fella who's in head of recruitment, if he does that every year, he should have a fantastic contract because he's worth millions, excuse the pun.
Yeah, I mean, Kieran, the club has been destabilised a little bit of late. And I think that we're seeing a knock-on effect of that on the pitch a bit with the fact of Dan Ashworth, who is, and also with John Morling as well. These are two massive players behind the scenes who make a big impact on and off the pitch. The figurative word for that we'll see going forwards. But I mean, obviously, we've also still got the head of recruitment, Paul Winstanley. But he's been there, so hopefully that will continue. But as Mark's correctly pointed out, that we've got Tony Bloom.
What Tony can offer is that, given his background, he knows the value of analytics, and what we are seeing in modern day football is, in terms of recruitment, those clubs who punch above their weight, and I'd include Liverpool in that. If you take a look at the spending of clubs since Sir Alex Ferguson retired, we've got Chelsea at 1.3 billion. We've got Manchester United and Manchester City also at 1.3 billion. Liverpool have spent £500 million less than those three clubs, but by far Liverpool are in the top two. They are the only people that is a genuine threat to Manchester City. And that's because Liverpool spend smarter rather than just spending for the sheer hell of it.
Do you know the other thing as well is the thing with Liverpool that, and you'll know this, that, you know, FSG own them, okay? And I'm pretty sure they could sell it for $2 billion to the Chinese tomorrow, with probably even more. But the great thing from the football club's point of view is that FSG already have this, they've got their own sporting team, haven't they? So it's in the baseball league. So, you know, they know about players losing form, players getting injured, all those kind of things. And they basically know how sport works. And they just leave Klopp alone. The chief exec, Billy, at Anfield, he's the kind of the liaison man, basically. But Klopp's just left because, you know, he's been brilliant. There's no two ways about it. He's brilliant. And I mean, you know, you as football fans, me as a footballer, would love to play for him because he's just what you see is what you get. But they know and they go, look, let him. Just do whatever he needs to do. But also, Klopp is very respectful of him because he knows they're not going to give him 50 or 60 million. So, you know, so they've got to look in. Obviously, they signed the two lads, as I said before, Alisson and Van Dijk. But, you know, they had to sign them then because otherwise they were going to go in elsewhere and everything. But what I'm saying is, you've got such a good manager, let him manage. And that's what they've done with him.
Well, that's what we're doing with Graham Potter as well. And we gave him that 6-year contract. But before we move on from Liverpool there a little bit, I mean, you mentioned the FSG group, and like you said, the stuff that they do with the States with their, all the other sports and stuff. But they did also still sanction the club to be involved in the European Super League.
Yeah, mistake. Massive mistake. And they soon saw the error of the ways, and they were wrong with the furlough as well a little bit. But you know what? Do you know what they did? And I mean, fans will never forget, but do you know what they did? They apologised, and they apologised straight away. And it wasn't Dominic Cousins or Cummins or whatever his name was who should have just apologised from the government. They apologised, and the big boss man, Henry, just went, sorry, we've got it completely wrong, our fault, and on they go. And you'll find that nearly all Liverpool supporters actually really like the Americans. They're just building another new stand there as well. So they've really put the money where their mouths are.
Kieran, this spectre of the European Super League, despite the threat of sanctions from the Premier League and the FA, is rearing its head again, or it is. You know, having a go in at the trap door, Kieran. So what is your take? I mean, is there anything that you heard or you know of that makes you think that any of those six are still champing at the bit to join this cabal?
I don't think any of the Premier League clubs are in a position, given what they've stated publicly and given they know how the reaction would be, to join the Super League. There is still enthusiasm in it in Spain and Italy. And the reason for that is that there is a Super League in Europe, and it's called the Premier League. And the likes of Real Madrid and Barcelona and Juve and some of the other Italian and Spanish clubs, they fear the Premier League because the Premier League's success has far accelerated ahead of the Spanish and the Italian leagues. And you know, Real Madrid, we're used to having it their own way in terms of signing players. And yes, there's still a huge draw, of we've seen, you know, the way that, you know, Courtois went there a couple of years ago, Hazard effectively down tools as well. but they can't dominate football financially the way that they have done historically. So what they're trying to do is to create their own tournament. They feel that they've outgrown La Liga, whereas I don't think that could be that accusation could be directed at any of the clubs in the Premier League.
But also, am I right in saying this? Is Kieran, aren't they in massive debt?
They are in a lot of debt, Mark. But I mean, the thing about debt's not a problem in its own right. It's can you service the debt?
Right,
and Real Madrid can do that. They've actually cut back their spending in terms of the last couple of summers, and in terms of the money that they're planning to spend on the redevelopment of the stadium. All of that's ring fenced, and it's a bit like Spurs. You know, while Spurs have borrowed a huge sum of money, as far as their stadium is concerned, they've got the equivalent of an interest-only mortgage. So they're not due to pay back any of the capital in terms of the Spurs stadium until 2051. And, you know, the chances are that you and I might not be there in 2051. And I suspect you still won't have got your 30 grand from Mike Bamba.
Yeah. And by the way, it'd be worth 350 by the time it gets exactly to 2051. Yeah. Listen, what have you heard about Burnley, Kieran?
I've got a lot of concerns about Burnley. The model that they've used is very high risk, and that can work. But if you take a club out at the knees, Burnley generates 88% of their income comes from Premier League TV money. Now, if Burnley aren't in the Premier League, even if they're getting parachute payments, that's going to cost them in the region of £40 to £50 million next season. How are they going to pay the interest on the borrowings? They've effectively used some of the club's own money to pay the old owners. So yeah, it's a very complex situation. I'm not convinced that they'll be in a good position if they are relegated. Their biggest asset is Sean, though.
Yeah. Well, I think if they get relegated, don't they have to pay £60 million straight away?
That's one of the rumours. I'm not sure that will be the case. I mean, there's another story going round that the old owners, Mike Garlick and co, have a buyback clause if the club is relegated. But again, the club's pushing back on that. I'm genuinely concerned about Burnley. They will either have to have a huge cost-cutting exercise, or they're going to have a significant refinance, but neither of them are good from a bounce back point of view.
And from a player sales point of view, there's not an awful lot of attractive options there, really, as well, is there?
There's not. You take me, you take Tarkowski.
Yeah, we take you, Mark.
Yeah, yeah. And you take the big centre forward that I think they've nicked him, Vachon or whatever his name
is. Yeah, he was great against us.
The left-sided player who plays on the right, is it O'Neill or McNeil?
Dwight McNeil, yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, I get what you're saying. But they've all played in the Premier League for so long. They'd all get good clubs, those lads.
Yeah, I think they would, but I think they might struggle for fees. You know, you look at Tarkowski and me. If we take a look at the market, the only players that tend to be generating more than a £20 million fee tend to be 25 or less. Burnley did extremely well to get £25 million for Chris Wood.
Yeah,
but that was from a desperate buyer.
Okay, well, just before we say goodbye, Mark. I mean, how do you beat a team like Liverpool? I mean, I saw the game against West Ham at the weekend.
West Ham were good.
Liverpool were playing a very high line. They look like if you've got pace, you can get in behind. And we have got pace.
Yeah, I think the only problem is Konate played, didn't he? And Konate, you know, is a bull and he's going to be a really, really good centre-back. But at the moment, positionally, he ain't great. And generally, if you looked at the Mikel Antonio's chances and one or two of the other chances, came right through the middle. And if you look, you can't see Konate anywhere near. So I suggest you get Klopp to pick him to play. You might get a better chance because the other fella, Matip, has been excellent. And they've now got such a good partnership. And Matip comes out with the ball now and commits opposition midfield players. So listen, you know, I didn't think you'd get anything at Anfield when you played them. You actually played really, really well and could have nicked the game. So you just never know. But just the way they are at the moment, and they're so bloody minded, it's frightening. It really seriously is.
Kieran, how do you beat Liverpool for you?
we need our best players to be absolutely on their game. And I think what we have seen in recent weeks is some of the players who started off the season extremely well have had a dip in form, you know, for a variety of reasons. We've been disrupted in terms of the solidness of the defence. Adam Webster's not played. Clearly, Dan's gone. Lewis has been suspended. You put those factors together and we've looked a bit more haphazard. Sometimes the communication at the back, which was always solid, there's been issues there, as we saw in a couple of the recent home games.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly it, Kieran, isn't it? Because we have had key injuries in key areas. And like you said, we've had four players out of form at the same time, which doesn't really matter. But I mean, that defensive solidity that we've had with, you know, the likes of like Webster and Dunk being together and actually improving together. I mean, Dunk had a blip. Webster is when he does come back, he's slow to come back. And it's all been a little bit frustrating because that solidity that we had where we were keeping the scoreboard ticking over because we weren't necessarily winning games, but like as Mark said earlier on, we were drawing too many games, but we were staying, we never got thrashed, we never got overrun, and we were always in games.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, clubs, we were not conceding more than one goal a game, and that always gave you a chance. And in our case, that chance tended to come in injury time, and we put it away. We're now two down, and effectively, I think deep down we know we're not going to score two goals too often, especially when we're chasing the game. So get it right at the back, screen the defence as well. I don't think we've been as good as we were at the start of the season. Yves Bissouma, I thought the first half of the season was playing the best football since he's come to the club. Since then, could be AFCON, could be matters off the pitch, could be that his head's been turned. We don't know, but his form has not been of the standard. Leo Trossard, again, has in the last few matches, has not been his normal self.
Yeah, Mark, you were nodding about Yves Bissouma there.
Yeah, he's a player, but I've heard he doesn't, I may be totally wrong, or he doesn't exactly lead the greatest of lives away from the football pitch. Is that right? He's a player. I mean, you know, there's no doubt he is a player, and they'll all be looking at him as to if, where, and where he goes. I don't really know. Would he go to one of the top four, top six?
I'm sure. He's good enough to play in one of the top sides in Europe, whether that be in this country or abroad, we don't know. But he's certainly good. I mean, Liverpool has certainly been interested in him. Man United interested in him. Arsenal are certainly interested in him.
AD, you have to remember that this is all, and then we're back to what we were talking about previously with transfer rumours and all these various things. All this stuff that we hear about is just tittle-tattle. It is the stuff you'll find, you know, in the Sunday. There's because he's still here, it shows that there's always been absolutely nothing in it. Because if Liverpool really wanted him, if Manchester United, if one of the big clubs really wanted him, he wouldn't be with us right now. And that's, you know, that's the case. Maybe they're looking for another season. Who knows? But, you know, the whole thing of Liverpool were interested in. Well, if Liverpool were interested in, Liverpool would have come and got him.
Yeah, I agree. But I mean, they're after selling Ben White for 50 million in the summer, I mean, is that the model we're looking at? Selling a player every summer.
Listen, that's a model that every other team apart from the top six are looking at. That's the way that it is. You know, and it was only a few years ago that Liverpool lost Suarez and Coutinho. So, and it's not the end of the world. It comes back to this recruitment kind of thing. If you know they're going to go, look at the money they got for Coutinho. Mm. Oh my God, Dick Turpin wore a mask. I mean, unbelievable. And, you know, it's like, so this thing about recruitment, if you get it right and you know there's a possibility let me say, the really good clubs, just say you had a Lionel Messi, you'd then be looking for the next Lionel Messi, but you'd be looking maybe in Argentina or South America for a 16, 17-year-old that people say, wow, he's going to be. And that's the kind of player that you're going to have to take. But
succession planning, that's what we've done there, Mark. Yeah. We've got Yves Bissouma's replacement already in the ranks.
There you go. Happy days then.
So
I think you've just made an argument against your own case here, Rady.
Yeah, but to be fair, it was a good argument, wasn't it?
A Okay, you're listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. We have, of course, got an association with oldfootballshirts.com. Sorry, you got distracted for a minute there. Mark, I did send you this shirt over, and I would like you to describe it for me, because I think you know who it is. Did you get did I send it?
Yeah, you sent it. Did I not play for them?
I don't know. You tell me.
Well, is it Tampa Bay Rowdies?
Yes, it is.
Did you know what they used to call the fans?
Rowdies?
No, the fannies. Honestly, seriously, they were called the fannies. I was playing coach there with Robbie Marsh.
We're going to have to break the beat machine here, aren't we, AD?
No, that's what this is. That's an American thing.
No. Well, you know, it's like, you know, you've got supporteries and you've got fannies.
Yeah.
Oh, don't get me wrong. I do appreciate that the word means something completely different in America. So we're all right with that.
Yeah. I mean, it's like a bum bag. It's called a fanny pack.
Yeah. Thanks for that.
Yeah.
So go on, AD, read Phil's choices on the Tampa Bay Rowdies.
I will. But I mean, can we just describe the shirt first, actually? Because Phil will get cross otherwise. It's white with green on it.
Right, thank you.
And the made by Nike, and Phil has photoshopped the big Rowdies thing off the front. But here's your shirt of the week. A little bit of subtle photoshopping. You might want to show your guests the real thing, but only after they've guessed the scene. Well, we don't need to do that, Phil. This, in my opinion, is a thing of beauty, says Phil, and one of my all-time favorite team names. This is the 1989 home shirt of Florida team Tampa Bay Rowdies. The team were originally founded in 1974, and they played in the NASL until the league folded in 1984. Mildly interesting fact, the NASL had bigger crowds than the current MLS does, and the Rowdies regularly played in front of crowds of up to 56,000. After 1984, the Rowdies carried on as an indoor team until 1988, when a fledgling American Soccer League was formed and brought the players outside again. Sadly, soccer struggled at the time, and in 1994, the Rowdies were dissolved. But good news, in 2008, the tide rose again and currently competes in the USL Championship, which is one below the MLS at the moment. The Rowdies have played in a number of stadiums, including the 71,000-capacity Tampa Stadium in the NASL days, and currently the more modest 7,500-capacity Al Wang Stadium. Over both incarnations, there have been many links to the UK and back to the day when you had Rodney Marsh, Tommy Smith, Sam Allardyce and Roy Wegley. And in the current incarnation, Joe Cole captained the side for 2 years between 2016 and 2018 before retiring. And so, of course, some links to the Albion. Let's start with this particular shirt. In 1989, Mark Lawrenson, made 20 appearances for the Rowdies in this shirt, scoring 3 times. And in the 1989 season, before hanging up your boots. Add to that Frank Worthington. He spent 1981 on loan at Tampa, making 26 appearances and scoring 11 times. Peter Ward played twice for the Rowdies in 89 and again in 91 before finishing his career with Tampa Bay Terror in the Indoor Soccer League in 1997. And so there we go. There's some names. Obviously, Frank Worthington left us recently. A player which we enjoyed watching for the Albion. I mean, obviously, you must have played against him a few times.
Frank, yeah. Extremely, extremely gifted. I always used to remember, though, when I never got too close to him because he always smelt of alcohol. So I don't know what that was all about, obviously. I used to leave him to... Now, he was a great lad, Frank. I mean, he played in so many... I think he played somewhere lower league and he was 39 or 40.
Yeah.
And certainly knew he was very old when he went to Preston, but he did a really good job.
Absolutely.
Yeah. There's a brilliant thing on the Twitter feed, on our Twitter feed the other day, which was it was World Book Day the other day. And I mean, Molly went to school as a vet from one of her favourite books. But there someone sent their kid to school dressed as Frank Worthington and a book of One Hump or Two.
Brilliant.
How did you work that out?
Brilliant.
Okay, quick notice board.
quick notice board. Yes, just to quickly say, we have two Renf matches this year on Friday, the 29th of April at Croydon FC. And the second leg, the return leg, will be at Sussex FA headquarters in Colville Road, Lancing, on Friday, the 27th of May. So that's the 29th of April and the 27th of May. £5 to get in each case. Please do come along and support it. We know that both Palace and Brighton are going to get behind it to promote it. So if you can come along as well and support the chaps, then please do come along. Kieran, as a former Renf player and someone who's basically done so many interviews today that you must be getting sick of it, so we're going to ask you the same question that you've been asked all day. What's going to happen to Chelsea?
If the government relaxes certain terms of the licence, which have been applied to Chelsea, presently Roman Abramovich cannot have any involvement. He cannot put money into the club, take money out of the club. The club cannot sell tickets. Chelsea cannot sell merchandise either. So it's got some potential problems. The Chelsea wage bill is £28 million a month, which will focus the minds of many at the club. And that's got to be paid in around about 2.5 weeks' time. So Chelsea are going to be playing potentially some matches where their fans will not be able to attend. We've got the FA Cup game at Middlesbrough in just over a week. If they proceed in the Champions League, then their match will at home will not involve any fans because it won't be able to sell tickets unless the government changes the license. And then we've got the potential sale of the club that cannot take place at present. But the Premier League wants a sale, Chelsea wants a sale, Roman Abramovich wants a sale, the government wants a sale. If we can ring fence the money from any sale proceeds and it goes into an account which cannot be accessed by Roman Abramovich, I think we can find a workaround.
Is this why he was trying to make it go to the Chelsea Foundation?
I don't think so. There's a variety of views as to the nature of the press release. And again, I encourage people to take a look at the wording of the press release very carefully. First of all, he came out with a statement which said net proceeds. Now, net proceeds is not defined. So I'd have to take care there. Then he spoke about victims of the conflict in Ukraine. Now, it could be that in his mind, Vladimir Putin is one of the victims of the conflict in Ukraine. So you can understand why perhaps there's been a little bit of caution and wariness. So I don't think the two were linked. A cynic would say that he made this announcement to try to come across as benevolent and perhaps to buy himself more time before any sanctions were introduced. Now, I'm not a cynic, as you know, but it did mean that he got effectively another week before the sanctions were introduced.
Yeah.
Given the way that modern finance works, that allows people to transfer an awful lot of assets very, very quickly.
I'll just say that what Kieran probably may not have been made aware of, it's possible he had, because I know his finger's on the pulse with everything, but something that happened today, and I've got this email that came through from the Football Supporters Association. Now, representatives of the FSA and the Chelsea Supporters Trust have had a meeting today with Tracy Crouch, who's the who works at the DCMS, the Digital Culture, Media and Sport Department in the government, about how they can move this forward. But and these discussions are wide-ranging, but one thing is said is one suggestion that was raised during the meeting was that ticket sales for Chelsea, and therefore I guess they can mean all kinds of sales, but certainly ticket sales they specifically mentioned here, could continue with profits diverted to Ukrainian humanitarian charities. The minister didn't rule this out, but it was clear that basically it's up to Chelsea to show that no funds would go to Abramovich before they would consider any amending any license to allow future ticket sales. The license is not set in stone and can be altered if the club can convince the government that Abramovich will not benefit in any way. All supporters on the call made clear their abhorrence over Russia's actions and stood with the people of Ukraine. And we finished the call once again calling for the fan-led review recommendations to be met in full via legislation, which should be referenced in the upcoming Queen's speech. So the upshot of it is that Chelsea fans... representatives of Chelsea fans have had a meeting with the government, and whilst it might be that junior ministers are, and I think that Tracy Crouch is someone who is who does listen, that doesn't necessarily mean to say that her bosses do. So hopefully, and knowing that we're talking to the right person, or that they're talking to the right person in government, you'd like to think that they will get the correct ear. But until such time as the government or the head of DCMS, which is the delightful Nadine Dorries, actually sanctions a change in licence for Chelsea at the moment, I guess they're kind of stuck, Kieran.
They are. I mean, I've had a few texts myself this afternoon with Tracy. I know Tracy very well. I've got a huge amount of respect for her as a conviction politician, and that's regardless of party politics. The government is going to be practical and pragmatic, and you can read into that whatever you choose. It is my viewpoint. It's not in their interests for what's happening at Chelsea to drag out. It's certainly not in their interests or anybody else's interests for some of the more lurid headlines that we've seen in terms of Chelsea going bust to crystallise. And I think that's very remote. Expect to see this as an ever moving feast and some flexibility in terms of the licence, which itself is due to expire on the 31st of May.
So, Kieran, I mean, obviously, I've seen so many different stories about this, and there are people who will be laughing at Chelsea fans about this, rightly or wrongly, probably wrongly, because I mean, they knew that he was a wrong'un when he took over the club in 2003, and they've had a lot of success in that time, and so people will be looking at that and thinking, well, is it fair on the fans? Is the long and short of it, really? Because they are being penalised for something that technically isn't their fault.
Well, how exactly are they being penalised? They've had two Champions League successes. They've had, five Premier League successes, numerous cup successes. And they've enjoyed the ride. And if it stops, that they, you know, whilst opposing fans will be sticking asterisks in the form of the trophies that have won, Chelsea fans won't. Chelsea fans will still have those memories. And that's what football's all about. It's all about shared experiences and memories, and they can't be taken away.
Yeah. And they are the current European champions as well, of course. But I mean, obviously, I mean, on a scale of 1 to 10, I mean, how screwed are they? I mean, people are talking about relegation and being expelled from the league and all sorts of stuff.
No, there's no evidence to support that. It's only if Roman Abramovich's Chelsea is no more. So it Chelsea Football Club, in an ideal world, will find a buyer over the course of the next ideally few weeks as opposed to few months. And then the new owner, just as Brighton Hove Albion should not be tainted because they were owned by Bill Archer at one point in time, why should Chelsea Football Club going forward be tainted because they were historically owned by Roman Abramovich?
And Kieran, before we leave, finish off here, I may have to ask you a very important question. Who would win in the fight, a honey badger or a blue ringed octopus?
I'm team honey badger all the way, especially if it's on land.
And that is all we've got time for this week. And so thank you, of course, to Alan Ware. Thank you to Kieran Maguire and to Mark Lawrenson. I've been Eddie Packham. This has been the Albion Rural Association with oldfootballshirts.com on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. Thanks for listening, and we hope to speak to you all again next week. Bye.
Love is this love. yes, I know, yes, I know, yes, I know now. Oh, yes, I know, yes, I know, yes, I know now. I'm willing and able. So I throw my cards on your table.